kill women and children. There was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. It was 500 women and children, and like 70 something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he still had 13 more months to go after he had to do that. And he had to go through, I don't even know how many villages they dropped him off at, that they had to do the same thing, because that's when, during the war, it turned into basically a genocide, and everything that was out there, they killed it. Men, women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, everything. They just went out there and they killed everything that they came in contact with. I got a ride from my dad and I went back to the state of California. It was Father's Day of 1997. I was coming home, and when I got to the house, I noticed there was a bunch of police cars outside of my house. And I thought maybe somebody had hurt somebody in my family, or maybe I was in trouble or something. I didn't know. So I hurried up and I pulled in the driveway and I asked them what was going on, and they said that they needed to talk to me. So I went and I went to the side with them and I started to talk to them, and they told me that there was some people that were riding some motorcycles and they had found my dad's body out in the middle of the desert in his car, and that he had committed suicide. And it was so hard for me, because all my life my dad was always there. He always tried to help me. He helped take care of me. He helped make sure that I had my prosthetic legs and everything. And just all of a sudden, all at once, all of that was gone.
This war in Vietnam, guess what? It wasn't going like the other wars that the United States had been involved in. They think the idea that, you know, maybe America didn't win like they thought they were going to, or that there was subversive reasons for us getting into the conflict or the war itself, that America mismanaged their military, or they were after natural resources, or they just wanted land close to China. There is so much controversy just around those parameters.
The people actually got to see the war on TV. It was broadcast. They showed all the people that were getting blown up and all the kids that were getting sprayed, and all the death and destruction of what the war was actually had going on in it. And once the American people saw how awful war really is, because most of the time in America, because nobody attacks America on their own soil or anything like that.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
This is the main Vietnamese language radio station in Saigon.
661, that order to get the snipers out.
When the American people saw this, they started having riots in the street. They started protesting at the government. They started, like, just having all kinds of problems in the United States over it.
So many years after 1975, that it's still in infancy. Like, I don't think historians even know what to write about it. I don't think they know what's real. I don't think they know what's false about it, what's mythological about it, anything. I think at first it came out of the veteran's mouth, my kids are sick, I'm sick, and they said, guess what? You're just a bunch of baby killers. You're just a bunch of whiners. You're a bunch of drug addicts. Now you just want a free handout. That's what they were met with.
Agent Orange was a safe product when it was used in the Vietnam War. and it's a safe product today.
We don't mean to say that there isn't an Agent Orange effect, but at this point in time, we don't seem to see anything that confirms that there's something there specifically.
Just hours before, thousands of Vietnam veterans were supposed to be represented in court against seven chemical companies. There was an out-of-court settlement.
I think they just try to sweep it under the rug so nobody knows, so that people won't be trying to go, well, wait a minute, I have a bad liver, or wait a minute, I have a brother that's missing an arm and we've never had birth defects in our family, or wait a minute, now I know why you don't have any legs, and all that. And then for all the people to come together and sue the chemical company, I think that's what their issue is. I think they don't want everybody to know about the Agent Orange, because if everybody knew how awful it was, and that the government, they would have to pay for medical bills and all kinds of stuff, and they don't want to do that, so they try to hide it and pretend like it never happened.
It's just still on the cusp. It's just out on the edge. Nobody will take it and pull it in. Very famous actor in the United States, Tom Hanks, currently doing The 60s. It's a documentary series that's been showing on CNN. I waited on bated breath. You know, he's talking about the 60s and the Vietnam War and showing film and how it affected. I was waiting. Come on. Nothing. I went to a speech with journalists who were here during the war, who weren't in the military but were journalists, very famous journalists in Pittsburgh a couple months ago. I waited. Come on, something, say something. Sorry. It makes me so angry. They just erase our history. They erase it, it's gone. It doesn't exist. They don't care. And that has been what we've heard our entire lives. You're controversialist. You just want controversy. You're just making stuff up. No, it's happened. They talked about everything. They talked about the strife. They talked about this and that and what it was like to be here and how the troops were and what it was like in the... Say something. You come here as a journalist and you stayed in Vietnam. You were able to see both sides of the story. And you've been back to Vietnam. And you talk about it. Say something. You know that the children here are still suffering. You know that the Vietnam vets are suffering. Say something. Nobody. You have people who are suffering, who have suffered their entire lives because of decisions people made in an office somewhere. They made the decision to spray this stuff. This is going to be a good idea. We're going to save people. People still today claim Agent Orange saved people. Okay, maybe it did. But those lives were worthwhile, and I don't diminish that at all. But there are millions of us that are suffering because of this chemical.
These people have taken me in. Like when we went to the Friendship Village and those Vietnamese veterans that came out, they were the NVA. They were the ones that were at war with my dad. And my dad probably shot at some of them, and some of them probably shot at my dad. And when I came face to face with those guys, that was a pretty intense moment, because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if all of a sudden they were gonna have a flashback because they saw an American face, or I just had no idea what to expect. But after he sat there and looked at me in my eyes for a good minute, and he came over there and he gave me a big hug, and he told me that Vietnam doesn't want war. They don't want to hate the American people, that they just want to live in peace from now on. And
Now that I've come and I've been able to put faces, it's been a wonderful experience to get the second side of the story. Every conflict, every problem has two sides. I'd been raised with one side of the story. Now I've gotten the second side of the story, and now I can take both those elements and put them together and formulate something to share with my children.
Just like my dad, I'm not going to lie about things when I get back to the United States and try to make it look nice or do anything. All my friends and family and stuff, I'm going to tell them how my trip was.
Once I came to Vietnam, I said, okay, this is more. This is more. This is bigger. This is bigger than Heather. Because a lot of my life was trying to deal with what happened to me. And when I came here and understood that the problem was way, way, way bigger than just me, or just a few of the kids that I had kind of connected with in the United States, I understood that I couldn't go back to just thinking of me and my story and my problems and those things. I knew I had to do more.
The Red Cross estimates that 3 million Vietnamese have been affected by dioxin, including at least 150,000 children born with serious birth defects. Millions of Americans and Vietnamese are still suffering directly and indirectly by the wartime U.S. spraying of Agent Orange and other herbicides over southern and central Vietnam. Question is, how many more generations must suffer, and how long will this deadly legacy of U.S. crimes against innocent lives linger on? Well, that's it, everyone, for this program. Until next time and another Aperture It's, goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. A survey by the homelessness charity Shelter found that 40% of people in rented homes had experienced poor health as a result of their living conditions in the last year, amounting to almost 3 million people in England. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a study, the social fabric of the United Kingdom's biggest cities is being transformed by sky-high rents and cuts to housing benefits as thousands of low-income private renters are pushed out of central areas, accelerating the suburbanization of poverty. The new study found a trend driven also by the gentrification of once largely working-class neighborhoods and the sell-off of social homes is excluding poorer people from inner cities and deepening divisions between rich and poor. It says low-income private renters, who a decade ago might have lived in city centres, are increasingly being displaced to a shrinking pool of affordable homes under urban periphery and beyond, often with poorer access to public transport, jobs and public services. The new study by the University of Glasgow found 1 in 9 private renters in the UK's 10 biggest cities were displaced from central locations to cheaper housing areas in the suburban fringes during the 8-year period to 2020. For example, in Bristol, the number of low-income households living in privately rented homes in the inner city fell by 38% during the period. Glasgow saw a reduction of just over 20%, while London, Sheffield and Liverpool all saw reductions of more than 10%. The findings illustrate political and economic policy shifts over the past 2 decades that are changing traditional perceptions of inner-city areas as the main locus of poverty and deprivation, and the suburbs as exclusively more affluent places. The phenomena, known in academic circles as the suburbanization of poverty, is especially visible in countries such as Britain, Canada, and the United States, where private rented housing has been deregulated and social security has been whittled away. Professor Nick Bailey, a co-author of the new study, said, "Continuing cuts in housing benefit levels, combined with the rising costs of inner-city renting, are engineering a fundamental change in the social fabric of British cities." Professor Nick Bailey added, "We need to examine the impacts this has on the welfare of poorer households as they are pushed to locations which tend to have worse public transport and worse access to jobs and vital services. But we also need to be asking whether this is the kind of city that we wish to create, one marked by deepening spatial divisions between rich and poor." The phenomena in part reflects the growing privately rented housing in the United Kingdom over the past 3 decades. While 1 in 10 households lived in this 10-year in 1991, it now houses 1 in 5 households, including many families. More than 1 in 3 children in poverty live in privately rented homes. According to the new study by Glasgow University, a decade ago, roughly 20% of UK privately rented homes were affordable for households in receipt of housing benefit. This fell to 9% by 2020. Housing benefit rates have been frozen since then, making inner cities where private rents have risen fastest even less accessible to poorer people. Joseph Elliott of the Joseph Rantry Foundation, a poverty charity, said, "It's clear that in large cities in particular, the diminished role of the state in providing social housing and cuts to support through housing benefit have resulted in people in poverty being priced out of areas with access to the amenities that we all need, such as easy access to work, shops and transport." Paul Sweeney, the Director of Policy and Research at the Centre for Cities think tank, said policymakers must consider the potential economic impact of the displacement of increasing numbers of low-income workers away from the city's centre jobs in sectors such as hospitality and public services. A British government spokesperson claimed, "We're helping to ease the pressure of rising rents and investing over £30 billion on housing support this year, on top of record financial support worth around £3,300 per household. We've also maintained our £1 billion boost to local housing allowance, while our discretionary housing payments provide a safety net for anyone struggling." Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Researchers said millions of British people living in damp and run-down properties are suffering worsening mental and physical health due to delays passing crucial reforms into law. A survey by the homelessness charity Shelter found about 40% of people in rented homes had experienced poor health as a result of their living conditions in the last year, amounting to almost 3 million people in England. Nearly two-thirds of renters in large swathes of the country, about 4.4 million people, said their mental health had worsened due to the housing worries since 2022. Campaigners are growing increasingly concerned that legal protections for renters, which are passing through Parliament, are being delayed due to opposition from Conservative MPs, of whom one in five are landlords. Osama Buta, Director of Campaigns at Shelter, said it is disgraceful that England's 11 million private tenants are at the mercy of a broken rental system while politicians sit on their hands and dither over whether to make renting fairer and safer. One of the main protections in the renters' bill is a ban on so-called no-fault evictions, known as Section 21 orders, whereby landlords can remove tenants without having to give a reason. Campaigners say Section 21 orders are one of the biggest causes of homelessness and are used by unscrupulous landlords to punish tenants who request basic repairs. The Conservatives first promised to ban Section 21 evictions in April of 2019, but did not introduce legislation until May of 2023. The bill had been expected to have a second reading in the House of Commons in the spring, but this is not expected to happen until November, amid reports of growing opposition to the reforms among Tory MPs. While the changes appear deadlocked in Westminster, official figures show that court proceedings for no-fault evictions have reached their highest level in the past 6 years. Research suggests someone is handed a no-fault eviction every 3 minutes, the equivalent of 543 a day, and almost 595,000 since 2020. A survey of more than 4,000 people in private rented accommodation in England suggests that delays to the changes were causing increasing ill health among those who fear eviction. According to the YouGov research on behalf of Shelter, more than 700,000 renters in London, almost 40% of the total, are suffering mental or physical problems due to worry of being evicted. People with disabilities are affected disproportionately by deteriorating health, with half of all disabled renters saying they had become more ill due to worrying about their living conditions, compared with 29% in the rest of the renting population.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it has agreed to a four-day humanitarian truce in the Gaza Strip. The movement says the truce, mediated by Qatar and Egypt, includes exchange of Israeli captives with Palestinian prisoners held by the regime. Hamas said in a statement 50 Israeli captives, all women and children, will be released in exchange for the freedom of 150 Palestinian women and children. Under the agreement, hundreds of trucks of humanitarian aid, including fuel and medicine, will be brought to all areas of the Gaza Strip. During the truce, the Israeli regime is to refrain from arresting or attacking anyone all across the besieged Palestinian territory. Also, air traffic will completely stop during the truce in the southern Gaza Strip. In the north, however, air traffic will stop for 6 hours a day.
Truce will be significant for humanitarian aid because it will allow for a large number of humanitarian aid trucks and convoys to enter the Gaza Strip. But I must add that the number of humanitarian aid or the amount of that aid that's going to be allowed in is nowhere close to what was the regular, let's say, a flow of humanitarian and aid.
Israel's cabinet has also voted in favor of the agreement. The war cabinet has reportedly been split on the issue for weeks. Some hardline figures believe that Israel's relentless bombing of the Gaza Strip was the best way to weaken Hamas and to free the captives. Others believe that Israel must get what it can now, however unsatisfactory.
Israel is failing military, and that's why it's in agony, and it wants a ceasefire to reset, because its ground invading forces are failing on the ground.
The agreement would reflect a change of course by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet. Right from the beginning of the war, Netanyahu announced that he was pursuing two main objectives from the war. The regime was trying to isolate and eliminate Hamas by destroying its military and governing capabilities. Netanyahu also promised to protect Israel from Gaza-based threats and attacks. Furthermore, he said his cabinet would free the captives without compromising with Hamas resistance movement. None of those objectives have been realized. Hamas has suffered some casualties, but its military capabilities, including its network of bunkers and tunnels, as well as its ability to launch retaliatory attacks on Israel forces, have largely been left untouched. Hamas and the resistance ideology is deeply rooted in the hearts and minds of Palestinian people in Gaza. Netanyahu had to abandon its uncompromising stance with regards to the captives. His cabinet was ultimately forced to strike a deal with Hamas in order to free them.
Well, absolutely. I don't think that the Israelis would have accepted to go into this kind of a truce without being dealt devastating blows by the resistance and by Hamas. Of course, the Israelis found themselves unable to achieve anything on ground, and they saw that this is a good thing for them to do. They are not doing it for the sake of humanity.
We can see from their statements in the Israeli Knesset that any truce would be a concession, and that proves that they have achieved nothing. But that's not enough. Despite the truce, all forms of resistance must continue.
Netanyahu's shift may have been critically influenced by his personal encounter with captives' families after weeks of refusal to meet them. Netanyahu and his Likud party have lost the trust and confidence of most voters.
Left! 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 Left!
We gather here in request that the one to be blamed is our prime minister, that he has to go down and leave his office and let another government to rule in Israel and try to make it better.
Internationally, the regime has also come under immense pressure. Thousands of people have held countless rallies against the Israeli regime and its bloodbath in Gaza, and calls war growing to refer Israel's genocide in Gaza to international criminal court.
As the world is watching a genocide unfolding in the Gaza Strip, another massacre is taking place against the Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank. Since the Israeli offensive began on the Gaza Strip on October 7, the violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank has also escalated. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinians there. The Israelis have cut off Palestinian villages and cities from one another by closures and settler attacks. That has resulted in a near standstill of commercial activities of Palestinians and their movements. Furthermore, armed settlers backed by regime troops have blocked entrances to most Palestinian villages, towns, and cities through military checkpoints, earth mounds, cement blocks, and iron gates. During the current offensive, the rate of violence practiced by settlers against Palestinians has escalated. That includes preventing them from accessing their lands, attacking them while picking olives, expelling them from their fields, and harassing Palestinians moving on roads.
We used to have problems with the settlers, but after the war in Gaza, they want to kill all of us.
After the war, the situation changed. They started attacking our houses. They didn't used to come to our houses. They started attacking them and the people inside them.
Preventing access to water and food needs, especially in the hurting communities, is done by Israel with the aim of displacing the Palestinian communities in those areas.
We have the same occupation and we are the same people. Geography does not, you know, divide people. We are just the same. We are all targets. Whenever you are a Palestinian, you are a terrorist and you should be killed. People are killed for no reason and for nothing. So, you know, this is complete genocide. This is complete war crimes that should be stopped immediately, right now.
Just days ago, Jordan warned against Israel's plans to displace Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank to the Arab Kingdom, saying that Amman would consider the move, quote, a declaration of war. The warning refers to a decades-old plan dating back to before the creation of Israel in 1948. This transfer plan, originally formulated by Zionist militias operating in Palestine and then endorsed by the regime after its creation, calls for mass expulsion of Palestinians to Egypt's Sinai Desert. After Israel's occupation of the West Bank in 1967, the idea of pushing Palestinians towards Jordan became included in the transfer plan.
There's also been a sharp increase in settler violence and takeover of land across the West Bank. Since 7 October, nearly 1,000 Palestinians from at least 15 herding communities have been forced from their homes. In the context of the coercive environment they live in, the displacement of these communities may amount to the forcible transfer of a population, which is a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Before the start of Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank was already witnessing the deadliest year on record for Palestinians. The worsening violence in the West Bank has fueled concerns that the Palestinian territory could become a third front in a wider war, in addition to the regime's northern separation line, where clashes with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah have taken place. Over the past 4 weeks, Israeli forces have raided Palestinian territories in the occupied West Bank in a bid to quell a rising resistance against the regime there. The Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank has now turned into a hotbed for resistance against Israel. The Jenin camp, with its high population density, narrow space, and adjacent homes, is very similar to the Gaza Strip. Hundreds of Palestinian fighters present a significant challenge to Israel's aim of destroying the military and political capabilities of resistance groups there. Israeli attacks on Jenin and Tulkarm are aimed at ending the resistance in the northern occupied West Bank so that it does not extend to the other cities. The regime has destroyed roads leading to vital institutions and centers that citizens need in their daily lives in those areas. The attacks on the northern West Bank are aimed at ensuring any future arrangements within Israel's vision of expanding settlements. But the October 7th resistance operation against the Israeli regime has proven that the regime cannot protect settlers.
The Israeli occupation policy today is that you need to accept being killed by the Israeli soldiers and the Israeli settlers without speaking. It is a gag order. They don't want the victim to speak up. They don't want the victim to condemn their murder of the victim itself. So that is the policy of the Israeli occupation, colonial, dictator regime.
Uh,
An Israeli minister has claimed that dropping a nuclear bomb on the blockaded Gaza Strip is an option. The Israeli Heritage Minister Eliyahu made the remarks in an interview with Radio Kol Barama. Eliyahu also insisted that allowing any humanitarian aid into Gaza was wrong, claiming there is no such thing as uninvolved civilians in Gaza, calling the innocent civilian population in Gaza Nazis. Following the remarks, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suspended the minister from cabinet meetings. Hamas resistance movement, however, pointed out that Eliyahu's remarks were reflective of the Netanyahu regime's genocidal mindset.
The statement by what is called the Israeli Heritage Minister in the Zionist cabinet that throwing a nuclear weapon on the Gaza Strip is one of the solutions didn't come out of nowhere, but it is an expression on the level of decadence, Nazism and sadism that takes place in the minds of the cabinet of the occupying entity that is based on murder and genocide.
The remarks also drew condemnation from around the Arab world, and Iran called for a swift international response. The United Nations Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency must take immediate and uninterrupted action to disarm this barbaric and apartheid regime. Russia has joined a chorus of condemnation that was sparked over controversial remarks made by an Israeli minister about the regime's openness to a nuclear strike in the Gaza Strip. Maria Zakharova, Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, said that the main issue was that Israel appeared to have admitted that it had nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other Arab states have all denounced the comments. Arab League Secretary General Ahmed Abul Qait has said the remarks revealed that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, which is an open secret. He also added that the comments also confirm the truth of the racist view Israelis hold against Palestinians.
Israeli forces raid Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, the largest medical complex in the Strip where thousands have taken shelter. The spokesman for the Ministry of Health in Gaza has said that there are only doctors, patients, and displaced people inside Al-Shifa Hospital. Regime troops entered the hospital's emergency department building while tanks surrounded the medical complex. The Israeli military said it is conducting the operation in a cult-specific area. Hamas resistance movement has said that Israel's leaders and the U.S. presidents were fully responsible for the consequences of the regime's raid on Shifa Hospital. Al-Shifa has been denied urgently needed supplies of medicines and fuel. Fuel shortages threaten the function of generators which run vital equipment like ventilators and dialysis machines. The World Health Organization has described the situation of the hospital as dire and perilous. The hospital's last generator has also run out of fuel, which has led to the death of several premature babies and wounded patients.
I am standing here at the ICU at Al-Shifa Medical Complex. This department is suffering after the shutdown of electricity due to lack of fuel. The health ministry warned about the lack of fuel. These people here were denied life support devices. They may lose their lives because there are no support machines or artificial respiration devices. Around 29 patients are facing this tragedy.
Israel alleges that Hamas has built its headquarters in bunkers and tunnels under the Al-Shifa Hospital, a claim rejected by the Palestinian resistance movement and hospital staff. Shifa Hospital has been one of the main targets of Israeli strikes since the regime began its deadly onslaught on Gaza. The situation remains tense in other hospitals as well.
And you are asking doctors and nurses to move people, knowing that that would kill them. And again, why would you need to move them? A hospital should never be under attack. A hospital is a place, a safe haven. This is agreed under international humanitarian law.
Music.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Bills and prices in Scotland have raced ahead of wages and benefits in the past year and show no signs of slowing down significantly. So it's a worrying time for many people in Scotland. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. ITV network has covered this story and tells us more. According to research released by Citizens Advice Scotland, almost half of people in Scotland say energy bills are their biggest financial concern this winter. The charity has launched a new campaign called Worried This Winter to encourage people who are worried about energy bills to seek advice from the Citizens Advice network. Based on analysis of a YouGov opinion poll on a sample size of 1,000, Citizens Advice Scotland research estimated 2.2 million people in Scotland, or 48% of adults, were worried about their energy bills. The research also estimated more than 1.4 million are worried about not being able to heat their homes effectively over the winter. Consumers can seek advice online, or visit their local Citizens Advice Bureau or specialist services like the Money Talk team. The average gain from energy-related advice across the network was more than £400. Citizens Advice Scotland Chief Executive Derek Mitchell said, "As the weather turns cold, it's perfectly understandable that people are worried about their energy bills and keeping their homes warm." He said, "We've faced the worst cost of living crisis in living memory, and people have had their financial resilience worn down." Derek Mitchell further said, "Our new campaign says to people it's okay to be worried this winter because the Citizens Advice Bureau network is here to help you regardless of your background or circumstances. Our advice is free, impartial and confidential." Mitchell added, "Lots of people may not realise that they don't have to go to a Citizens Advice Bureau to get advice and information from our network. We have online self-help tools and advice pages that can help you see where you can cut your costs, boost your income, and understand your rights with your energy supplier." Scottish Government Energy Minister Gillian Martin admitted, "Energy bills remain significantly higher than this time 2 years ago, so campaigns like this are vitally important to ensure consumers are receiving the support that they need." The Daily Record has also covered this story and tells us more. The British newspaper The Daily Record has also covered this same story and tells us more. More than 1.3 million Scots are struggling to make ends meet on their current income due to soaring inflation. Citizens Advice Scotland analysed new research from a YouGov opinion poll and found almost a third of people are struggling to pay their bills on their salary. Citizens Advice Scotland is now encouraging Scots who are worried about money or bills to seek help from their local Citizens Advice Bureau. The Scottish Government claimed it was already helping the least well-off in society despite its limited powers. Citizens Advice Scotland spokesman Miles Fitt said, Many of us are feeling the squeeze of the cost of living crisis, but it's still startling to see well over a million people are estimated to be finding it difficult under present incomes. Miles Fitt added, bills and prices have raced ahead of wages and benefits in the past year and shown no signs of slowing down significantly. It's a worrying time for many people. He added, there's nothing to be embarrassed about when well over a million of us are worried about money. It's affecting so many of us. A Scottish government spokeswoman said the combined impact of a decade of austerity and economic mismanagement by the British government and the economic damage of a hard Brexit means people in Scotland are facing an unprecedented cost of living crisis. She added, much of the Scottish government's resources are going towards mitigating this as far as we can with the limited powers and fixed budget available to us. Tackling poverty and child poverty in particular is central to the work of the Scottish Government and the policies of this government, including the game-changing Scottish Child Payment, and mean that an estimated 90,000 fewer children will live in poverty in Scotland this year. Website The National has also reported on the same story. According to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation charity, 500,000 people are in very deep poverty in Scotland, with statistics showing women and ethnic minorities are disproportionately at risk. It looked at relative poverty, very deep poverty, and in-work poverty and found housing costs were particularly detrimental to working families. According to a new Joseph Rowntree Foundation State of the Nation report, more than 1 million people, including about 250,000 children, are living in relative poverty, while a tenth of the Scottish population, nearly 500,000 people, are living in very deep poverty. It showed that 60% of children living in poverty have at least one parent who works, and one-tenth of workers were paid below the real living wage for at least 4 in 5 years. People from a minority ethnic background experience a rate of in-work poverty more than triple the rate for white workers, while 70% of those trapped in persistent low pay were women and another 70% were single. Almost three-quarters of families impacted by in-work poverty have at least one person working in retail, hospitality industry, healthcare and social work, administrative and support services, and or manufacturing. Housing costs had a huge impact, with 110,000 people in working families pulled into poverty due to their housing costs. The charity said the British government is in denial over the cost of living crisis and that a work-first approach had failed to reduce poverty along with changes to universal credit. First Minister Humza Yousaf has pledged to call on the British government to legislate for an essential guarantee to ensure universal credit should protect people from going without the essentials. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation Associate Director for Scotland, Chris Burt, said, "The Scottish government can still meet its child poverty reduction targets, but it needs to get a move on." Chris Burt added, "While the Scottish Child Payment is providing crucial support to families and starting to drive poverty down again, it isn't enough. A major reason for that is the failure of work to be a reliable route out of poverty, particularly for women. Some of our biggest industries are trapping people in low pay, unreliable hours and underemployment." Chris Burt added, "There are things governments can and should do, but businesses need to engage with their workforces to ensure employees are able to secure an income that supports them to get by." Chris Burt noted, "At the same time, decision makers are sleepwalking towards another winter that promises to be crushing for households across Scotland. The Scottish Government will need to react to this in its forthcoming budget, but the British Government in particular seems to believe the cost of living crisis is over. And that is wrong."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Elam commemoration ceremony.
یکی از خصوصیات دیگر ایلام حضور همه جانبه همه قشرا بود. تا از عالم برجسته فاضل اونجا مرحوم آشق عبدالرحمن حیدری رحمت الله علیه که در میمکم با ما بود، بنده اون بالا ایشونم مرحوم آشق عبدالرحمن چند بار بنده آمدم، چه قبل از ریاست جمهوری چه بعد از او.
Another characteristic of Elam was the wholehearted presence of people from all social backgrounds, from scholars to the common people. For instance, the late Sheikh Abdul Rahman Haydari, may God's mercy be upon him, was with me on the Meymak Hills. He was with me at the top of that summit. He was with me everywhere I went. I visited Elam several times, both before and after my presidency. He was always present in the field of battle as long as he was alive. He would take his gun and was ready to fight at all times in the true sense of the word. The same is true of the common people and the numerous tribes in Elam. Those who could fight were present in the field and the masses of the people helped in the resistance. One of the gentlemen in the meeting stated that the people did not leave the city. I myself saw this with my own eyes in the city of Elam. The enemy planes would regularly strike the city repeatedly. In those times, no one would remain on the streets and the people would go to one of the deserts or forests around the city. After the bombardment had finished, they would go back to the city. That is, this way of leaving and coming back to the city had become a routine activity for the people. But they never completely left the city or the province, and they stood firm.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
خب وقت در زیر همین بمباران هاست، در همین شرایط سخت است که یک نخبه نابغه مثل شهید رضایی نژاد تربیت میشه.
It was during the time of those bombardments and in that difficult situation that a genius, namely Martyr Rezai Nejad, grew up. Martyr Rezai Nejad was a nuclear scientist who was martyred. His scientific importance was so immense that the enemy felt his existence would help the Islamic Republic progress, and so they assassinated him. They martyred him in front of his wife and small daughter. That young scientist had spent his youth witnessing those bombardments and those difficult circumstances in Elam.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. Gave me hope, oh Allah, I want to
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A group of Italian journalists, representatives of media unions and organizations, gathered at the Roman Press Association in Rome to discuss how the ongoing conflict in the Gaza Strip has been biasedly covered by the media so far. The initiative was organized by the No Gag Network, a group that advocates for freedom of expression in Italy, as Palestinian and international journalists trapped in the coastal territory continue to be slaughtered by the Israeli occupation forces.
As of today, we don't know if these journalists have been executed or they have been killed in their homes together with their beloved ones during the Israeli bombardments. And I ask you, would that make any difference? It is horrific anyway.
During the meeting, journalists agreed that a war needs field reporting, condemning Israel's refusal to heed calls to allow independent reporters to access Gaza for direct testimony. Since October 9, the 2.3 million residents of Gaza have been experiencing a devastating near-complete communications blackout.
Killing a journalist is a war crime, and we call on the International Criminal Court to proceed with the examination into what's happening in Gaza.
The Italian journalists also relaunched a petition already signed by 200 French, Palestinian and Lebanese journalists demanding access to Gaza and the protection of journalists covering the Israeli onslaught on the Strip.
La libertà d'informazione viene seppellita sotto le macerie.
Freedom of expression has been buried under Gaza's rubble. Only journalists embedded with the IOF are in Gaza, operating under the observation of Israeli commanders in the field.
Speaking of freedom of expression, the future of journalism in Italy looks bleak. There has been a big question mark over the credibility of Italian media outlets in recent years as the sharp divide between the mainstream media and a large chunk of public opinion has been growing deep.